Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham. Once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, huge guest from the band Metallica, Robert Trujillo, is on the show. And this is a really fun one. More on that in a second. But first, if you'd like to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. Thank you, Tristan, for all your hard work for this show. I really appreciate that. More on that in a second, actually. And if you'd like to get in touch with me, you can find me at Left for Damian on Twitter or Instagram. There is also a TikTok page for the show, a YouTube page for the show, and a Facebook page for the show. All of those are found at Turned Out a Punk on their respective platforms. Is that Instagram? Instagram page too, if I didn't say it. And there's videos that I put up that I make out of some of the fun facts from old episodes, and you can find all of those over on those things there. I play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. That's how I first met Robert. You can find us, more information about us, over at fuckedup.cc. We will be going on tour of the East Coast of the United States coming up. And there's some great, it'll be actually some really cool shows coming up for that thing as well. And I will see you out there on the road. And that is it. On to today's show. As I said off the top, Robert Trujillo is on the show from the band Metallica, a Los Angeles bass legend. And this is something that, hats off to Tristan Abraham, my brother, as I said off the top, and guest booker for this show and producer for this show, and Steve Martin from Nasty Little Man for putting this together, because this has been years in the making trying to get Robert on the show. And I got to be honest, like, I had not really come across a lot of stuff about Robert's punk rock past in my research prior to this and in other interviews I'd listened to and with him, and always been a fan of him. And you know, obviously he was in Suicidal Tendencies, but you never know. You know, I always thought he came to it through more of a friendship connection and a musical proficiency connection. And anyway, I just hadn't read how deep it went. And oh my gosh, spoilers on this, but this is a fun episode. Metallica has a brand new record, and I heard it. This was an incredible kind of cloak and dagger mission where I got to go and listen to this record all by myself in secret, basically. And it's awesome. If you're going to listen to this thing when it comes out, this record is going to be premiering in movie theaters all around. I got to look this up. Probably the world, but certainly North America, because it's happening in Toronto. I know it's happening all over the United States, and they'll be doing screenings with this record. Like, how many rock bands in 2000, what year are we now? 2023. The years fly by. 2023 can pull off having screenings for their records. Like, I can't think of too many bands. And I got to say, there's been so many questions people have asked me about this record since I've heard it. And it's amazing. It's a real journey kind of throughout Metallica. And I think reflects a band that's kind of transitioned from, you know, just band to cultural institution. You know, it's like kind of a rarefied air. And there's few bands that kind of exist in this space, like maybe the Rolling Stones. And I'd say the Grateful Dead, in a way, where these bands kind of have cultures unto themselves. And anyway, we dive into all this with Robert in a second, but check out this new Metallica record. It will be dropping this Friday. If you're listening to this thing, I guess Thursday night, if you're going to the movie theaters and watching this thing, you can find out more information about screening times or whatnot over at Metallica.film. And so head on out to a screening or listen to this thing where you consume your music, or head out to an independent store and buy a copy of 72 Seasons. And yeah, I'm very excited. This is a huge event. This is like this record. It's rare that you get a big events like this in music, as I said. So I'm excited. All right, that's it. Everyone sit back, relax, enjoy Robert Trujillo on Turned Out a Punk. Robert, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Appreciate you.
Oh, well, I appreciate you. Believe me, this is a big one for me because, you know, obviously Metallica being, I think, you know, I was talking about this with some friends today, probably the biggest rock band in the world at this point. Like, I can't think of another band that could pull off movie screenings for a new record.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's all surreal to me, you know, because as you know, I came from a different universe, you know, growing up. And I remember when Suicidal Tendencies, when I was in Suicidal Tendencies and we were opening for Metallica, and probably this would have been maybe 93. And I just remember seeing Metallica, you know, we're the opening band. So I'm watching Metallica and the size of it all and everything. And it just didn't seem real, you know. I was like, and I'm on that stage playing too, but I'm just kind of like, wow, you know, what a massive machine, you know. It's impressive, you know, it's definitely impressive. But you know how it is, you got to stay grounded.
Well, yeah, and it feels like even like from that stage where I'm sure Suicidal was playing with them with you, to the stage you wind up joining the band, to the stage we're at now, it feels like, you know, like the ceiling keeps going up. You know, it's not like the band's kind of like hit a level and stopped. Like, it's still, I was talking to a friend of mine today and he was talking about how his son, completely independently from him, has gotten super into Metallica. And wow. This is like a 12-year-old. And this is at a time when, you know, you've got kids. Rock music doesn't necessarily speak to kids in the same way it did in prior generations, yet there's still something about Metallica that's finding kids.
Yeah, I mean, you know, actually, I feel that Metallica has this youthful quality to, in a sincerity to a lot of the music, you know. The earlier stuff, it just kind of speaks to everybody, you know, elders, middle-aged, youngsters, you know, there's something for everybody. I mean, I remember when I was coming up, my motivational music was actually Slayer and Metallica. And you know, I'd go running up in the Santa Monica Mountains preparing for a Suicidal tour. Maybe this was 89. And I was listening to like Ride the Lightning and Kill 'Em All and, whatever three Slayer albums, you know, take your pick. And that was the motivation for me back then, you know. I remember when these bands first came out. Actually, it's funny because both Slayer and Metallica came out at the same time as Suicidal Tendencies' first album. So it all came up at the same time, and it was actually the same tribe, especially up in the Bay Area, because, San Francisco would accept Suicidal Tendencies, the band, but I wasn't in the band at the time, but Suicidal couldn't play in LA. They were banned from there. So there's just sort of this youthful quality to Metallica that resonates till this day. And I remember in 2003, when I first joined Metallica, there was a meeting with management, and one of the managers said, I don't know what to say, because Saint Anger was about to come out, and he was worried. He was actually like, you know, the enrollment or whatever for the fan club had substantially dropped. Album hasn't been released in a pretty long time. There was all this uncertainty. And I just remember feeling like, wow, you know, that's motivating. That's not very motivating to hear from your manager that he's worried about the future of Metallica, basically. And, you know, Saint Anger came out, and it just was more of an introduction to the band, and that, you know, the band is back, Metallica's back, and, you know, we're doing stuff again. And then it was really Death Magnetic that kind of re-sparked it. And that's when we started seeing what you're saying, you know. It's like, wow, you know, there are kids out there, and there are grandparents out there, and there's everything in between out there, and there's skaters and, you know, gangbangers and, you know, skinheads and, you know, punkers. And it's just like diverse, and things started to kind of propel from there, you know.
Well, I want to get there, but I got to go back further. When do you remember coming across punk? When was the first time you ever heard about the genre, Robert?
Well, for me, punk, you know, was vibrant on the west side of Los Angeles, all over Los Angeles in the early 80s. And obviously being in high school at a time when a lot of musicians were basically either punk or metal. And I always kind of was somewhere in between. I embraced it all. I mean, I was listening to Suicidal Tendencies before I ever even knew Mike Muir, you know. Fortunately, my best friend in high school and junior high became the guitar player. That's how I got in the band, Rocky George. And it's funny because some of the musicians that are actually on the first album are still my friends, like Luigi Mayorga, the bass player, original bass player, is still a really great friend of mine. In fact, my son plays bass and he loaned Ty a bass for a recent video they did, a song called Dance of the Dead. And it's actually the original bass that tracked Institutionalized, Subliminal, I Saw Your Mommy, and I said, Ty, this is a historic instrument. You got it.
That's awesome.
You gotta play this thing. So, you know, there's this connection that goes way back with all these sincere punkers who really were in the trenches. And I used to see shows in backyard parties in Venice back in the day. It was a band called Neighborhood Watch.
That LP is unbelievable. Yeah.
Neighborhood Watch was one of the bands, and No Mercy and XL was a part of that tribe. And we just had a lot of these really cool, young, fired up bands. And they kind of revolved around the energy. Definitely revolved around the energy of Suicidal Tendencies. And then there was Black Flag right down the road coming out of South Bay, Redondo Beach area and all that. It just seemed like there was just this vibrant punk scene that revolved around being a surfer and a skater. And that's what I was. You know, I never was a great skater, but I used to practice all the time. I had my Jay Adams skateboard and I was listening to, you know, some of these bands. And it was just a way of life. It was a lifestyle for us. But at the same time, I'm not going to lie, I loved Black, you know, obviously Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and some of the new wave too as well. And then when I discovered bass, it was like, you know, definitely leaning towards the R&B and, you know, kind of Motown and all that. So I was taking it all in, you know, coming from the beach and embracing punk and jazz and everything, you know.
Well, I read an interview that you talked about what I think is the birth of LA punk, Earache in My Eye. I think that to me is the first LA punk song. And I went back and listened to it today and it rages. And it's funny because that's 74, right?
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting about that is, that song was kind of a cult hit at the time. And I still, till this day, I have a weird band, strange offshoot band that I do with Kirk called The Wedding Band, and we play a punk set. We cover, you know, Dead Kennedys, you know, California Uber Alles. We play Misfits. We play like Black Coffee and Rise Above by a Black Flag, you know. We really have a lot of fun doing this, and we've done this in recent times. You know, we did a show a year ago, and that song, we actually covered that song a couple times, and it was great. It was beautiful to play it with a horn section, and we did that just before the pandemic. We actually covered that song with a horn section, and that was a very powerful experience.
Did you record it?
It's out there. It might be on the internet somewhere, but we didn't record it, you know, like as far as for release or anything, but we mix up our sets. Like we'll literally play half the sets punk rock and then the other half is Black Sabbath and like Kool and the Gang or something, you know. It's like we have a lot of fun. It gives us the opportunity to really sort of, you know, let our hair down. And we do this after shows sometimes, like literally with Metallica, we'll play a show with Metallica. And then, you know, an hour later, we're on stage, you know, at the Fillmore or, whatever local bar, tavern or ballroom that will allow us. And it's just a lot of fun, you know. But Earache My Eye, I would say that's definitely an OG classic. You know, he's basically rapping in a way. I mean, it reminds me of like now that you mention it, it's kind of Suicidal Tendencies, the same thing.
Totally.
It's a story in its spoken words, but then there's a groove and a riff to it, and a foundation with this really cool music.
It's almost like a super angry version of The Fall, I've always thought.
Yeah. Again, coming from LA and everything, and you know, having the Latinos and the Hispanic community, being a Latino myself, and being able to identify with you know, Cheech Marin and you know, the culture and all that, it was a lot of fun. You know, that song was a lot of fun, and it resonated, especially for the times. And then the big rolling paper, you know, when you bought the vinyl, you got a big rolling paper. It's like, you know, yeah, those were good times. Yeah, the lyrics on that are pretty kind of infectious. They just win you over. It's undeniable, you know. And you know what? Chong, Canadian guy.
Absolutely. And also, I think his name's Gay DeLorme, who played the riff on it. Is born in Thunder Bay, but grew up in Edmonton.
Really? Wow. So
a strong Canadian LA connection in that song.
There you go. I just realized that.
Yeah, it's one of those songs that, you know, like you hear it now, and it would have been something like, you know, yourself, like Rocky George, like all these people are kind of hearing it. So it is weirdly foundational to punk. Like, it doesn't get taken up in the way the Stooges or you know, your friends, the Velvet Underground, get taken up, but it gets taken up kind of like differently, you know, like it, but at the same time, it is just as important to incredibly vital music that comes out of Los Angeles later on.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's got a certain ingredient where the riff is heavy enough, you know. It's like da 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 da. It's simple, but it's effective, and you want to bang your head to it. And that, to me, is something that you find in a lot of, you know, obviously a great metal bands, and like, imagine a song like Sweet Leaf by Sabbath, you know, don't, like, you could imagine a horn section playing that, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, it's not different than Earache My Eye. Really.
Yeah.
The same, you know, it's the same recipe.
Well, it's interesting, 'cause I, like, obviously, you know, you work with Ozzy extensively, but like, they're to me, like, after the original inception of rock and roll, like, they're the next band that's kind of like a great sonic leap forward to me, like more than Led Zeppelin, because they're a band that kind of like shifted it and kind of opens the gate to this whole other world of kind of like darker music that's going to come out of it.
Right. And it's very alternative, because Sabbath was really different. And like you said, they brought this scary ingredient to their whole thing. And the funny thing about that is I've heard Ozzy tell stories about when The Exorcist came out, they were on tour and they went to see it, and they were so frightened and scared shitless by this movie that they used to share hotel room, right? So they're all in a hotel room, they slept with the lights on, you know. And I could just imagine, you know, these young British guys going to see this movie. I was probably in the States, you know, and, you know, they're just like afraid that, you know, they're going to become exorcised or whatever. Possessed is the word. But, you know, those kind of stories, when I hear them, I just think it's hilarious, because Ozzy would say, can you imagine the Prince of Darkness sleeping with the lights on because he was frightened by The Exorcist? You know, it's just I've been blessed, because I've, you know, become great friends with my heroes, but also been able to create with them and tour with them and all this. So I get to hear some of the funnier stories. But Sabbath definitely had, also, when you talk about like just that punk edge, they had that, because, I mean, Bill Ward and Ozzy were they were kind of the whole Jackass concept, and so they were doing that shit way before
it was popular. The Winnebago, right? They were turning
exactly. They were doing that stuff way before anybody, and it was sincere and honest and very. It would be very dangerous to do the things that they did now. I mean, in this day and age, and it's amazing that they survived it. Jeez.
Well, that's what I always think about. Like, you know, I play in a band with a swear word name, but I have the blessing of coming in a post Metallica, post Slayer, post Suicidal Tendencies, post Nirvana world. Like, I could only imagine what it was like during his Black Sabbath at that time, dealing with cops, dealing with just anything you're running into. It must have been super out of this world for these people to see.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, those guys, and there's a lot of other, I know a lot of skaters that probably have similar lifestyles historically, but, you know, they survived a lot. And you know, I always say that if there's ever a movie made about these guys, it's going to be the best, probably one of the best ever, because just the stories I've heard. But again, they fancied themselves like a blues, jazz, you know, soul band in a lot of ways. And they found that evil, you know, flatted fifth in their music and turned it into a whole, you know, genre, really, which is a statement in itself, you know.
Going back to, I guess, legends on a smaller scale, but like, it's interesting because it brings up something you brought up earlier. Did you ever see Pap Smear, Rocky George's band with I think Jeff from Slayer was in it? It's around...
Oh, no. I didn't see them play, but Jeff and Rocky used to, it's funny because back in the old days, they would prank call me all the time, and they used to call me Lizard Boy. And so 3 a.m, I'd get these calls or these messages on. Back then, it would have been, you know, we had our phone machines, answering machines. And it, hey, Lizard Boy, you know, and all this. And the interesting thing about Jeff and Rocky, just really best friends. And they would geek out on everything from rap bands like Ghetto Boys. Actually, believe it or not, Jeff Henneman turned Rocky on to the Ghetto Boys. And, you know, they got into NWA. They were like into all that music before it became popular and kind of just won everybody over. They already were on it. You know, they're already checking this stuff out. A lot of that came from Rick Rubin too, because Jeff, you know, obviously was working with Rick. And Rocky would then turn me on to this. So I was learning from, you know, Jeff was, I guess, kind of getting it from Rick. And then Jeff was presenting it and sharing it with Rocky, and then Rocky was sharing it with me, and Jeff was always super cool with me. You know, he just, even on the Clash of the Titans, he was great. And in more recent times, you know, the Big Four, he would actually come to my area where I would, you know, my little base zone with Metallica, and he would hang out and have a beer there, you know, with me. And I mean, I don't know what it was with him and sort of the other guys in the band. He was either more shy or just more punk, you know? I mean, he's just more like, he's just rooted in punk, and he really did love Suicidal Tendencies, obviously. So he kind of liked to hang out in my zone. And it's a shame that he's not around. He was he's really an amazing player, you know, vital to heavy music as we know it now.
100%. Rest in peace. Because it's amazing how, not just for metal, but for, like you're saying, because he rep punk super hard, and like Metallica repping punk super hard. It's amazing how much it comes up on this podcast as that being people's on ramp to getting into punk music.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, I mean, I always say, you know, with riffs, you know, and sort of the attitude and the edge of all that, you know, where you come from and how you came up, you know, like think about Birmingham, you know, and the music that's come out of there. I mean, geez, you know, Diamond Head, Judas Priest, obviously Sabbath, and many, many more. But there's just, it's not a beautiful place, you know? I mean, it's an edgy place. It's like, you know, industrial. I mean, the South Central LA, you know, where these guys all came up, like Hetfield grew up, you know, on that side of town, and it was rough back then. So imagine, you know, you come out of high school or junior high or whatever, and you're being chased by gangs, and you're kind of in the thick of all this heavy, you know, probably aggression at times too, coming from all around. And, you know, you're going to write some riffs, you know, that's going to propel you to create some badass stuff, along with, of course, the influences that you're going to bring in, you know, from all over the world. But I'm just saying that there's something to be said for how you come up and what you experience in your life and all that stuff in your youth. Which
it's reality music, you know, it's people singing about their realities and what they're seeing, and rather than fantasy music or.
Yeah. You know, you really, it's in you, it's ingrained, you're feeling it, and that's what comes out, you know, in your creativity.
So you went to high school in Culver City, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Did you know a band Hated Principles that would have been starting up early 80s?
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah. What about them? That's great. So now we're getting into something, because Mitch Twersky was a good friend of mine, and I remember I think it was the singer. There was a whole tribe that from Culver High that hung out, and I know there's Mitch Twersky. I mean, the names are kind of
Cats. I think Cats Brothers, maybe the last name.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And there was a guy called Danny Tunick who played drums. And Danny was an incredible musician. I mean, Danny could play. This is insane. Danny, you could say play Black Dog by Led Zeppelin on the bass. And you'd hand him a bass and he would, like, it'd be sloppy, but he'd like figure it out. You know what I mean? Play it on the piano. You know, he was just one of the, and he was a drummer. I mean, it was like, and he had all these crazy doodles on his wall, like on his wall. He had all these doodles everywhere with Sharpie, and these guys were out there. But I do remember Hated Principles. Yes. It's so weird that you brought these guys up. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because by the time, you know, Fucked Up starts going out to LA, those guys are still kind of around. Like, they're like kind of, I guess they were lifers, you know, like we played with them at a Long Beach warehouse, or at least some of the guys were in another band at a Long Beach warehouse. And so I love that. And you really get that in Los Angeles. There's almost sort of this like continuity to this punk scene where like, it's more than just music. It's a culture, like you were saying before, like it's a culture, that a lifestyle that people kind of like took on and stayed with it.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, I there was a huge punk festival in Ventura just this past weekend on Saturday, and I saw actually Suicidal play. Still amazing. I mean, it was really, really great. Pennywise also played. I'm good friends with Fletcher. I mean, Fletcher everybody knows Fletcher. I'll get calls from him. It must be 3 a.m. and he's in like you know, some bar in like Spain or something. Hey Robert, say hi to my friends, you know. I mean, 3 a.m. for him. And yeah, so you know, but anyway, I ran into Greg Hetson, you know, Bad Circle Religion, Jerks. Circle yeah. Jerks, Red Cross. And I caught up with him for a while, and you know, just lifers, man, you know, mild mannered, cool, but lifers to the craft, and you know, a lot of history there. And people were coming up to him, and actually much respect. And the people that were coming up to him are guys that have history in punk as well, you know, like diehards, more on the fan level, but that are sort of integrated into sort of these camps, like the Suicidal Tendencies camp and everything. And they're going up to Greg and they're like, much respect, you know, music wouldn't be what it is, you know. It's cool. It's great to see, you know, because usually in punk rock, the musicians, sometimes they don't get the credit that they deserve. And, you know, they're pretty humble about it Like Greg's a humble dude, but you know, I thought that was really a moment. And this just happened Saturday. It was just a few days ago. And let me tell you, the crowd was pumped, massive crowd. I mean, this music is still here. Yeah. And vibrant, and there are hardcore bands that are kicking ass, and that whole movement is growing. I see it with my kids because they're listening to some of these bands, a lot of them, and just loving it. And they're getting me into it now. You know, bands like, you know, Vain FM and Tsunami and Terror, and you know, these different groups, and I'm getting sucked in too. And I'm like the oldest guy at the gig. I'm sitting there like an old man and I'm watching all this go down. So I feel like, yeah, that's, there's something brewing, and you know, and that excites me actually.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. It does feel like for kids now, this is something that would speak to them, because like the kids want real, and this is mm-hmm. music that's kids telling them that they can go and do this and become that next mm-hmm. generation. And it's wild to think of, you know, like we're running through names of people back then, like obscure bands and well-known bands and kind of bands in between. And you guys are all coming out of this like little tiny, ultimately section of Los Angeles, like sometimes mm-hmm. in the same high school. And it's just wild to yeah. think of how many talented people got entry to music through this world. And I guess backyard parties as well, right?
Yeah, a lot of backyard parties. Fortunately, we had, you know, we had the, well, we have not so much lately because it's been raining like crazy, but we have favorable weather, you know, and that definitely helps the backyard scene. You know, it's funny because last Sunday, my son played a gig. He's got two bands. He's got a hardcore band called Feed the Beast. And then he's got Auto, which is a power groove, but very melodic. And both bands actually played on the Venice Boardwalk, and the cops came and shut it down. And it was like just sort of edge of your seat kind of tension, but also exciting. You know what I yeah. mean? It was like, and it's like, man, this hasn't happened. You know, like some of the people that were there were like, you know, this hasn't happened since the Doors. And then after that, it would have been Jane's Addiction. And now it's happening with, you know, with Auto. You know, it was fun, you know, it was definitely fun because the cops came, and so they obviously couldn't play. They had to stop playing. And then when they left, you know, it was decided that, you know, that just go for it. You know, it's kind of like, just let's play two more songs, you know, them. And they, so they played two more songs, and everybody's like waiting for the cops to come. And so the plan was two more songs, grab the gear, throw it in the truck, in the van, you know, like immediately, just, you know, like, so there was like this kind of train of people handing, you know, amps and PA gear and everything and throwing it into the truck, you know. But that's kind of, you know, that's the old school way, you know, that's what's starting to happen again. And even in the slam, the mosh pits, you're seeing a lot of this kind of violent energy. But the truth of it is, it's like kind of attached to this more of a loving, you know, are you okay? I just broke your nose. You know what I mean? It's like that kind of a thing. Whereas back in the day, as you know, it was like, I broke your nose on purpose. You know what I mean? Yeah. It was like, or, you know, it was very different in that way. You know, violence was a little more, had a certain intent, you know, back then.
Well, how hairy were those kind of early suicidal shows? Like, I'm sure you were going to some of those early ones, right? When they were just kind of...
Well, the early shows were the most violent, you know, that you can imagine, because there was, you know, a lot of different factions coming to the gigs and stuff. And that even transitioned into when I was in the band, like, but in places like Milwaukee, you know, and like, you know, we're kind of on the tour bus and the skinheads are waiting for us outside, you know, like weird stuff like that. And yeah, there was some fights along the way for me, but back in the early days that you're talking about at the Olympic, there was always, you know, someone was getting into it. And it, like back then, like I would just go to a party in Venice in like early 80s, and it was guaranteed there was going to be a fight. You know, it was just like, it just went with the territory. It wasn't maybe, it was always, there was going to be a fight, you know, plan on it, that kind of a thing. So, you know, for better or worse, that's how it was. And it was really, really prevalent, you know, in the early days. But at the same time, you know, it goes with the territory. If we had more time, there's a lot of stories. Like most of my friends that are musicians now, doing well, like my friend Dave Kushner from Velvet Revolver, man, he tells me stories about Mike Muir, like seeing Mike Muir, you know, getting some shit and then looking at him and saying, don't even try to Dave. And Dave's like, okay, you know, because it was maybe a rival faction or something, you know, and they showed up. There was just that kind of thing. I grew up also, because I grew up on the West Side, I worked at a pizza place, and couple things I want to say real quick. So I worked at a jazz club, and on weekends there would be this new age jazz music and this courtyard, and there was outdoor, you know, in the sun. It was a vegetarian place, and the Suicidal guys lived next door, so they would take their PA gear and they would turn the speaker columns towards the outdoor concert that would be going on at the Comeback. It was called the Comeback Inn. And they'd be like, you know, and with like all this nice saxophone and this real, you know, smooth jazz, you know, and yeah, yelling obscenities to the owner of the club. They didn't get along so well. The owner of the club, he was a German guy, Will was his name. He would roll into the kitchen because that's where Suicidal used to rehearse. And he would, you know, he would basically tell them they're playing too loud or whatever. And so they had this kind of, you know, fighting, you know, neighbor feuds. And then they would, you know, send it back at him through the PA system when he would have these concerts. And I worked there. I was a busboy. And there was a surf shop that was also sort of attached to the same complex, you could say, and all those guys used to hang out there. And this is before I was ever in the band, so you know, that's always a fond memory. And I worked at a pizza place, and you know, that's where we had all the Dogtown skaters and the, you know, the surf team and all that were hanging out back then. So a lot of history in the area, all across the board. Very progressive and energized creative community back then.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm kind of fascinated by, like, you know, it feels like it was, at least in the sort of wider media coverage, stifled post Manson and post Sunset Strip riots, like youth culture, I mean, in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And like, it's almost like this explosion happens, like you're saying, like across the board, be it metal, be it punk, be it skateboarding and surfing too, I guess, but also yeah, like hip hop too. Like, it just feels yeah, like this sort of like, that we're still in, like that explosion that kind of comes out of the West Coast there, is it just changed everything forever.
Yeah, that's a good point, because whether it was, you know, you mentioned the Manson family, they were hanging out at Venice Beach, they were hanging out in Topanga Canyon where I live now. They were a part of the DNA, and it wasn't even just the Manson family. There was a lot of different cults that were sort of rooted in the same, obviously not the violence, but it was like, you know, just free love, and they, a lot of them were musicians or trying to be rock bands at the time, you know, going into the early 70s. And I remember an incident when I was living, when I was staying at my grandmother's house in Hawthorne. The Manson family robbed a army surplus gun shop around the corner. And the cops, you know, obviously they surrounded the whole area. So one of the Manson members ended up hiding in our backyard, in my grandmother's backyard. So the cops were all like, you know, had the guns pointed. God. And so my cousins and I, we hid in the shower, and my dad went to, you know, it's like, again, it's crazy because the light, you know, the helicopter was flying and lights were flying through the window. It was like a scene from like Close Encounters. And my dad went to the front door and he kind of tried to open it to see what was going on from that perspective. And the cops all had the guns drawn, and they said, you know, basically get the fuck back in the house. And
wow.
And yeah, and they, you know, they got, if you go on the internet, you can read about it. It was in Hawthorne. And basically the plan was Manson family was gonna steal these guns and all this ammo and then hijack a plane at LAX and demand the release of Charlie, because he had been incarcerated. So they wanted to demand the release of Charlie, and they were going to like fly to Mexico or wherever the hell they were going. And they obviously, you know, didn't pull it off. So the next morning, my cousins and I were looking for like bullet shells, and we're like, you know, and this is like literally right, you know, two houses from the main street where the store was. And that kind of energy, you know, just like between the factions and the cults and seeing these characters on the Venice Beach boardwalk, but at the same time, you know, you're on your skateboard and I'm a little kid and I'm seeing the Hare Krishna people, and they used to scare me, you know, something about them scared me. And, you know, all this, you know, different religions and, you know, obviously the music scene was vibrant. That was in the 70s, obviously, so it's different. You know, it's an exciting time. You really could, you know, pull from that and get motivated. And that those are the things, all that madness is what propelled me to be creative and to actually, you know, I would do crazy things. Like I would ride my bicycle with my bass on my back, Or I would prop it up on my handlebars on my bike, and I'd have an amplifier, and I'd be kind of like riding, you know, miles. I mean, not just like down the block. I mean, it'd be more like 2 miles to my friends to go jam, you know.
Yeah.
And that was the inspiration, because between the bands in the backyard parties to the bands on the Venice boardwalk, you know, just the street musicians to the, you know, what you would see, you know, on you know, TV or whatever, you know, everything was just vibrance. And there was that hint of danger, you know, like I was talking about with, you know, you hear something in the news, you know, somebody's on the loose. It's just like, you know.
Well, that's why I feel like that, you know, because there's a sort of historic moment that the first wave LA punk people, like the Mask kind of people, talk about, where hardcore came in and it ruined everything for them because these kids brought violence. And I think what these people fail to understand is like what was actually happening is these kids were just bringing their reality. Like this was things that people were dealing with. Like these gangs weren't formed at punk shows. Like these gangs were formed for protection in neighborhoods that kids were a part of, that ultimately became part of their punk world. But it's not like, it wasn't like this sort of sinister plan to ruin the scene that I think it gets painted as sometimes, because like you're saying, this is like a rough, LA is a rough place for some people.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, and I know I've heard Lars talk about it, you know, wanting to belong and needing you know, a community and you know, I guess your tribe, finding your tribe. And a lot of the people that I grew up with came from, again, you know, they single parents, a lot of freedom. The freedom that we had back then was just ridiculous. It's like you're like, my parents were younger, you know, so it's like my mom, she was 19 when she had me. My dad was 21. So, you know, they're still having fun. And, you know, they divorced when I was 5. So they're doing their thing, right? And I'm just sort of left with my cousins. And, you know, my cousins are taking me out late at night and we're on skateboards and they're robbing like gardener trucks and doing stupid stuff. And which, you know, obviously isn't cool. But I mean, it's like, that's kind of what you got thrown into, you know. You just, you're stuck with your tribe, you know, and you know, trying to find a way to just have fun with your freedom. We used to, like, things I would never do, like climbing on railroad track bridges and stuff and storm drains that, you know, I mean, it's just, and your parents don't even know where you are. You come home at midnight and it's like, oh, he's home. It's cool. You know what I mean? It's just like, they don't know where you were or anything. And that's just how it was for a lot of the kids, you know, a lot of the skaters actually were just, and I guess at the same time, that's kind of what made, you know, either the bands or the musicians, but also, you know, the athletes, you know, really great, because they just had freedom and time because the parents didn't care. The parents were, you know, they were battling their demons. So basically it was just like, yeah, man, go play rock and roll. Yeah, man, go, you know, do whatever, you know, go ride that ramp, you know, or, you know, oh, they're you're going to that skate park. Oh, okay. Who are you going with? Okay, yeah, we don't know them, but that's okay, you know, just make sure that you give us a call later. It's like, you know, it's just kind of how it was.
Well, and like, as much as there are sinister people within these scenes, at the same time, like, what a positive place for kids to wind up, where you're driven to play music, you want to get better because the people around you are all playing music, like, or like you're saying, the athletes, the people that are doing skateboarding, like, these ultimately become safe spaces for kids. And without these things, it's like, where would people, like you're saying, be in storm dreams without, if you didn't go to band practice?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I told my friend's father, my friend's dad, that one time, and he was like, you know, you shouldn't be hanging out in storm drains. It's it's not safe. You know, I'm like, oh damn, I gave it away. You know, yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just, you know, again, going back to the, you know, your tribe and, you know, and how you came up and, you know, being motivated by, you know, all the musical energy, but also, you know, I remember like listening to Black Sabbath because my friend's older brothers were totally into it. And we would like, you know, turn out the lights, light a candle, and then we would play, you know, the song Black Sabbath, and we'd scare ourselves and we'd imagine that, you know, Ozzy was this mystical, you know, man, you know, and try to talk like him and all this stuff. It was just silly, you know, but that's how we were, man, you know. But we'd also, at the same time we were doing that, we'd be doing dance routines, you know, to, you know, trying to pop lock and stuff, you know, because we like Parliament Funkadelic, you know. It was like, it's kind of all over the place.
Yeah, no, and it, like, obviously it drives you to become, you know, not just a musician that's playing backyard parties, but like, you took it to the next level, right? Like, went to pursued it academically.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. At a certain point, I, you know, I started playing in various bands around town. I was taken on a lot. I mean, kind of more classic rock, but then I would be in like a new wave band, and then I'd be in like some kind of a more funk driven band. I had a band called True Colors at the time, and there was a lot of bass in that group, a lot of this, a lot of that, and it was a lot of fun. You know, we played the clubs that we played. There was a club called Madame Wong's West.
Yes.
And then, yeah, we played there a lot. And it's funny because I remember seeing like Glenn Danzig there playing, you know, Danzig, and I remember you know, running into James. I didn't know him. It was before the 93 tour. And I just thought, oh, like there's James. And some friends of mine and I were going to go up and jam, and we were actually going to play Ride the Lightning. And I was drunk and I was kind of pretty stupid at the time. So I was like, hey man, will you jam with us? And he goes, and James had a beer in his hand. He's like, no, he goes, if I'm going to jam with anybody, I'm going to jam with him. And he points at Glenn, Danzig. Yeah. He's like, okay, that makes sense. And then we just butchered the song, of course. It was, I don't even remember playing it. I do remember this. So the publication, the LA Weekly, was there. And then Mike Muir was quoted as saying, because a couple of, I guess myself and maybe the guitar player, I'm not sure, got up there to play this Metallica song. And he was like, this was very embarrassing. And please do not associate me with this performance. Something like that, on how crappy we played this song, Metallica and everything. But it was fun. Everybody's hanging out. And, Madam Wong's West was one of the places where you could see a variety of bands, mostly though it hinged a little more, it was a little more or less sort of sunset metal. It wasn't so much that was primarily the sunset scene, and all that was happening obviously on Sunset Strip, but parts of like North Hollywood and a couple spots down in Orange County. But Madam Wong's West was more kind of new wave and punk, more of that kind of a vibe.
I guess carrying on the old Madam Wong's kind of tradition.
Yeah. Well, Madam Wong's East.
Yeah.
There was two venues, and there was Madam Wong's East too. That was the first time when Rocky George recorded his first album, Join the Army, with Suicidal Tendencies, Rodney Bingenheimer, who was the DJ back then for K-Rock, K-R-O-Q, we were all in this parking lot. The band I was playing in at the time, we were in this parking lot, and they had one of those the arm barricade. And we didn't want to pay. So the singer, he was in a truck, and there was like two or three cars behind. And I remember listening to the radio, and it was Rodney Bingenheimer, and he was like, hey, we're all waiting to bash through this barricade. And it was perfect timing because, and I'll never forget this, because Rodney's basically introducing the song War Inside My Head, the new single from Suicidal Tendencies off the Join the Army album. And I'm like, oh my God, and I'm turning up this special moment, and literally right in perfect sync with the guy, lead singer, puts his arm down, like, revs the engine, and we all break through the barricade, and it's like, whoa, like a chase scene. And I'm listening to War Inside My Head for the first time, then, whoa, it's on my head. And I'm like, oh, and it was such a moment for me because I was so proud of Rocky. Like, he's made it. He's on the radio. Rodney's talking about his band. And it was just like, oh man, this is great. Yeah, and that was Madam Wong's East, actually, when that happened. So a lot of memories, all these memories that revolve around the punk scene and just being a young musician coming up, inspired.
Well, I wanted to ask you, because like CJ Ramon came on the show one time, and unfortunately the episode got lost, but it was an incredible conversation because he talked about how when he joined the Ramones, it was such like a rough period for the band, and like being this guy that had come through the military, and he felt like it had prepared him for this situation. I was going to ask you, like, if James that night had turned to you and been like, do you want to join Metallica? Do you think you would have been ready for what you ultimately had to do? Cause it's like very well documented in the movie. It's a very rough period in Metallica where right. you kind of come in right. and, like you were there, I don't know, but I think if another personality who's been in there, who hadn't been through being in a band with Mike Muir, being in a band with Ozzy.
Right. Well,
would they have been able to handle it?
Well, at that time, as a musician, as a player, I don't know that I would have been able to handle it, because like when I first joined the band, the workload was so intense. Like it was it exceeded anything I'd ever experienced in terms of the workload and the responsibility, and you know, the back catalog was so extensive, and I don't know if I could have handled it back then. You know, it would have been like I mean, in 2003, when I joined the band, it already had taken me 2 years to get caught up just in terms of learning, you know, back catalog. And then also having to learn the entire Saint Anger album, you know, which hadn't really been recorded like as a sort of unit. I didn't play on that album, of course. So learning an album, you know, the Saint Anger album in its entirety, and then also trying to figure out what songs Metallica is going to go on tour with, you know, was a challenge for me. So there was a lot involved. So the funny thing is when people say, oh man, that's so cool when you got the gig and you must have been so happy, you know, what did you do? And I'm like, I didn't do anything. I immediately thought to myself, I got to roll up my sleeves and get to work, you know? So if you're going back to 91 or whatever, when that was, I don't know that I would have been ready to take that sort of responsibility on at that level. I was still learning. I was still growing. I'm always learning and growing. Everything that I ever do, you know, everything that I've ever done in my career, I was learning and growing with Suicidal Tendencies, obviously. You know, I was even just learning how to tour. I mean, I wasn't used to lobby calls or anything. And so Metallica is a, you know, especially back then, it's like Metallica parties hard, but guess what? You got to be ready for that 6 o'clock wake up call, and you got to get on that stage and handle your, take care of your business. You know what I mean? And represent. And again, it took me a good 2 years to just sort of catch up in learning the set. So all that early stuff were like in 2003, 2004, I'm like literally, you know, I'm just absorbing it all, and I'm trying to just figure out where I belong in Metallica. And then it wasn't sort of until Death Magnetic where I started to kind of catch up on the songs that I needed to learn. And I started learning songs like Dyer's Eve and, you know, Call of Cthulhu. I started like jumping ahead of them, and I started learning songs that they never even played, like Frayed Ends of Sanity. I learned that thing 3 years before we ever played it, because I never wanted to feel the way I did those first couple years trying to play catch up and having, you know, cheat sheets on stage sometimes. And I but there's nothing else I could do. You know, it was just like overwhelming. You know, eventually, you know, like I said, I probably knew a few more songs than they did, you know, and I never wanted to bother them too. Like in learning the songs, I always really dove deep. I even got the music books, because we didn't have, you know, now you can go online and you can find the bass to anything, or the guitar parts, anything. It's all on there. You know, you go online and it's like, I want to learn how to play Frayed Ends of Sanity. Let me see. You know, you can find out how other people are doing it. You didn't have that option back then. You know,
you had to buy the sheet music, the black album sheet music thing that everyone had as a teenager.
I was literally like going into that, and I'm in the band, and I'm like going into, you know, into these books. And I was just going to say that's because I wanted to learn as much as I possibly could before I had to ask, you know, like, James, how does this part go? You know, I wanted to learn like 90% of the song, and then I could say, what note is that? Or what, you know, and especially with Justice for All, because it was really hard to hear the bass on that. So, you know, there was a guy in New York who actually recorded bass and like he was able to like track bass and then have it on the actual record. So you could, it said, it was called Justice for All with Bass. And I actually met, like, I ran into the guy just within the last year. He's a tour manager now. His name is slipping from me right now. But we were laughing about that. I go, I listened to your CD, man. You helped me. And I was like, you kind of helped me. But so, you know, you find ways to do it, to get it done. And then, and that's just how it is. You know, you got to work, dive in. But when I got the call to join the band and then the call to come up to San Francisco, my life changed. You know, I immediately was sort of thrown into this new world. You know, I didn't have a family back then. And obviously, a couple of years later, you know, I have a family. And I wasn't down in LA for a long time. I come down for a day or two, but I was, you know, really kind of, you know, integrated into, you know, working and being up in the Bay Area, and it was sort of my new life for a while. So everything was really intense at that time.
Well, because, like, you know, you watch the documentary, and obviously your playing gets you immediately in the door. Like, they say that when you're done, they're like, you know, Robert nailed it. Like, he was so in the pocket for all this stuff, and so you're in there. But, like, watching that documentary, seeing those people, and I don't know all of them personally, but I've met some of them. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Metallica is able to do this new record, which is a monster, by the way. The new album is fucking fantastic. Oh, and your vocals are killer. Like, yeah, I didn't know it was you doing the vocals till I was like, who do they keep bringing as guest vocalists? But yeah, it's wild. Like, but it's a, I just don't know if Metallica is able to get to this album with any of those other dudes. I don't want you to shit talk them, obviously, but like any of those other dudes doing it, because I think in addition to being this incredible player, you're obviously someone that can navigate Psycho Mike and also navigate Ozzy Osbourne, two of these sort of legendary personalities. So,
right. Wow. Yeah. That's a good point. So, and this is important, and I've said this, you know, kind of recently, when you're in a band, as long as, you know, I've been in Metallica or some of these other groups, you know, again, Suicidal Tendencies, 9 years, Ozzy Osbourne, 7 years. You know, I worked with Jerry Cantrell on his Degradation Trip album for a couple of years, and Jerry was in a bad place. You know, he was a challenge. When I was working with Zakk Wylde on some of the Black Label stuff, helping him out, and it's no secret, Zakk was he was a wild dude. He was wild. You know what I mean? Yeah. I just sort of ended up in various musical situations where I think I got the members or the musicians at their kind of most radical time. And coming from a family, you know, with my dad and everything, and being challenged with, you know, certain personalities growing up, you know, now here I am in the world of being in a band. And to have a successful run with a band, you really have to understand the people, the individuals, and you have to know how to cater to their personalities, and you have to be flexible. All this is super important. There's a lot of great players. I mean, there's a lot of great players. That's only part of it, you know? And I'm a writer, I write. I mean, it's like, you know, I love songwriting. You know, I co-wrote Ozzy's new record. And but that's not the main thing in Metallica. You know, it's like writing is part of it. It's like I will contribute 100% as a writer if it calls for that. You know, if I'm my role is to support someone else's song, which often, you know, it is, or to support your brother. You know, it's like, hey, James needs a friend. You know, I need to be a friend now. I need to be, you know, more than a friend. I need to be a brother, like Kirk, you know, Lars. It's like, that's how it is. You know, you've got to be flexible. You've got to be sensitive to the situation. And that's involved. And I look at my career and I look at how things were with Ozzy and how to deal with that. And sometimes, it was challenging, because you never knew what was going on. But I would never turn around and go, oh, you know, like disrespect Ozzy or disrespect any of the bands I played in, because they helped me become who I am. You know what I mean? They helped me grow and become a better person. Of course, become a better musician, but also to become a better person, which then I can obviously bring that into Metallica and help keep this, this magic alive, this magic carpet, keep us going. And and I do believe 72 Seasons is a product of, the challenges of whether it's the pandemic or whether it's, other things that were challenging, say 3 or 4 years ago. There's always going to be something, and I always say you're in the jungle, and you got mosquitoes and snakes and creatures coming at you, and you see the light at the end of that, at the end of that jungle, and you want to get there, And that's, and sometimes it gets rough, but then you get there and then you have the success and, it that sort of thing, So it's never easy, man. You got to keep rolling with it. But 72 Seasons is a great album. And I tell you, it's the best one I've made with this band. And it's a collaborative record. It's a very collaborative record. And I love that. I love it when we can actually contribute on that level. And every note is played from the heart, And that has a lot to do with not being able to be together in the beginning of this, because we were writing from, our home studios together and creating that way. So once we got in the room together, it was like, oh yeah, man, it's like, it just felt that much more special, I think, for most bands, obviously. So 72 Seasons resonates with the energy of us being back in the room and celebrating, that, magic and that energy of jamming and communicating, with our instruments again.
The way it's sequenced, it really does feel kind of like a journey through Metallica. Like, it feels it starts thrashier and ends closer to sort of like, early 90s, mid 90s Metallica, It feels like it. Was that a deliberate thing, or is that like just.
Well, I think, in general, Lars, he definitely likes to look at the overall recipes of great Metallica songs, and then all of a sudden it becomes, the art piece, so to speak. It's like, imagine a blank canvas, and you're like, okay, if you're thinking about Sad But True, you're thinking about this, you're thinking about, an epic, like In Inamorata is an epic, That's we say that's the shortest 11-minute song Metallica's, it's the longest song Metallica's ever made. And it's, at the same time, it just feels like it's not 11 minutes because it's really well arranged and produced. We have a great team too. I mean, our engineering team, Greg Fiddleman, our producer, and that whole tribe, that has come up from LA to bring this music to the world sonically is just great, because they're so committed, they're soldiers within. And and as yourself, your producers and your engineers and your artists, your graphic team, everybody, you're like a family. So this album speaks to them as well. Our techs, are some of the best, our crew. So it's a powerful statement on a lot of different levels, and it is what it is for those reasons. It's the musicians, of course, but then having your family with you, your Metallica family, to be able to create and have things sound the way they do and all that is essential.
Well, Robert, this has been one of my favorite conversations I've ever gone to have. It's lived up to all the expectations. I Hated Principles. We got to talk about Hated Principles. That was,
yeah, that is a name from the past, man. In fact, when you said that, I started to see the members. Like, I actually, in my mind, I started to see, I think Mark was the,
I think so. I wish I had written down all the names, yeah, of the, I actually was going to bring over the 7-inch, but I didn't want to steal Nardwuar's gimmick. There's Mitch, Jose, Captain Anarchy, Dave F, Don Secchi, Drew Von Busick, but
yeah,
Mitch T too as well.
Apparently. Yo, Mitch Twersky. Oh yeah. My god. Oh damn. Okay. All right.
Before I let you go, can I briefly ask you about what I think is probably the most misunderstood, maybe rock record ever, and a record that I hated on at first, but it was actually Dale Crover from the Melvins that was like, you got to listen to it mm-hmm. and appreciate it, isolated from all the bullshit that people are putting on it. And that's Lulu. I went back and listened to it recently. Yeah. It's kind of a record that, you know, years from now, people are going to go back to and try and understand it in a way they just seem to reject it on concept.
Well, Lulu was very important for a lot of reasons, because I feel like Lou Reed really helped sort of instill this, like he was opposite in a lot of ways than, say, Metallica would think in terms of how to create. And he was like, Lou's thing was like, there's no mistake. Every note, you know, is important, you know, so you can never have a mistake, you know. See, if you, whereas, you know, obviously in the tradition of Metallica back in the day, it was like, if you hit a sour note, man, you know, you get the death stare or whatever, you know. And whereas Lou's saying, there's no mistakes, man, you know, it's just like, this is art, you know. It's like, to be able to have those moments where we could just create without kind of like, how do you say, you know, just kind of free, you know, mm-hmm. there was some free moments where mm-hmm. we were just riding that wave together. And some of that magic is definitely on there. And you know, I really like the music video we did with Darren Aronofsky was pretty cool. Some of that stuff, yeah, you listen back, and if you give it a chance, you listen to some of those riffs, you know, it there's something there, you know what I mean? It was definitely experimental.
Yeah.
And we learned a lot from that experience, which then helped the next phase of creativity and you know, and Hardwired and all that. You know, we're always learning and growing. That's what I love about Metallica. There's no shortage of riffs. I mean, it's crazy. That's why you get so many riffs in a song, because there's so many great riffs. And, you know, between James, Kirk, and myself, just like there's almost, we almost have too much to present. So a lot of stuff doesn't even get heard, you know? So it's just like, there's just no shortage of ideas. And it's true, when we put on our instruments, you know, we're like back in the garage, you know, it's fun and we're having a good time and we can leave everything in life, all the other things in life, put that aside and enjoy the music together at our age. And that's why I know and believe that there's still going to be great music coming out in the future, you know?
Well, you got to keep writing those riffs, because hardcore bands need somewhere to steal from.
I hear you, man. I hear you. Sometimes I'm like listening to their stuff going, damn, I like that, you know. I gotta remember that one, you know. It's really great. Yeah, that's a whole nother thing. I love it. It's inspiring. I came back from a show at the Belasco. Is that what it is? There's a new venue down in downtown LA. I think it's the Belasco, and also there's the Regent, and you see these bands play. And you walk out of there and you're glowing. You're just like, you know, it makes me want to actually, you know, when I get home, I'm picking up my bass and I'm trying and I'm coming up with riffs, because it's inspiring. And that's coming from, you know, the younger tribe. I love that. It gives hope for live music. And I think it's all coming back, my man. Yeah.
Well, it's here. Love this. I love this. Robert, and anytime you want to come back and talk about backyard shows or Hated Principles or any of it, yeah, you know, you're always brother. Welcome.
All right. Cool, man. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Robert will hopefully be back one day for a part two, because I didn't even ask him about the Iconochrist cover that him and Kirk did, or I didn't even ask him about Neighborhood Watch and not follow up on that, because there was just so much, so little time. But appreciate Robert for coming on the show. And again, thank you, Steve. Thank you, Tristan. That was awesome. Speaking of awesome, though, we're going to keep the awesome coming because on the next episode of Turn It to Punk, it's going to be a splits, and we're going to keep another four-chord wonder in the house in the form of Glenn Matlock. And because it's a splits, it's not just one but two returning guests. I'm putting together a fantasy draft of one of the great rhythm sections for punk you could put together. Glenn Matlock and my buddy, my pal, my hero, my mentor, John Worster, from the band Mountain Goats, formerly of Superchunk, also in unbelievably successful comedy duo, Sharpling and Worster, one of the greatest comedy duos of all time. I've said this forever. There's no one that has a streak like they have in comedy for knocking it out of the park in the form of The Best Show and Calls on the Best Show and other projects they've done together. Anyway, we don't talk about that next week. We talk a lot about Glenn Matlock and Rich Kids. And man, John is amazing on this episode. It's a good one. Glenn's impressed. Well, that's it for this week's episode. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights and stop hate and violence towards people of different faiths and different religions and different races, because we're not talking about political issues. These are not political issues. These are basic human rights issues. People deserve to be able to live free from hatred and violence and discrimination. So if there's organizations that you see affecting positive change in your world and you think they should be supported, support them. And donate your time, donate your money, you know, try and affect positive change. Speaking of which, punk is somewhere that you affect positive change by getting involved in. So start a band, start a fanzine, draw a poster, do something, get involved. You know, it also helps mental health. Speaking of helping mental health, try meditation. Anyone can do it. You know, you just sit there and you know, I know people have known this for centuries, but it's something fairly new to me. And my gosh, it is beneficial. You know, I'm finding great benefit in slowing things down and you know, just breathing. So, you know, and if it doesn't take it first, try it again. It took a while for me too. And you know, as I say, it did come eventually. Also sign your organ donor card, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you're literally dead meat. And they can't, you know, what are they going to do? You know, but just waste them. So, you know, I've seen it happen with my own eyes. You can perform miracles by signing that organ donor card. And that is it. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Stay safe, and I will see you on the next episode.